Support comes from St. Louis Public Library Foundation, helping the library serve children and their families with programs and services needed to become lifelong readers. More information about the foundation is at slpl.org.
This is St. Louis on the Air from St. Louis Public Radio. I'm Elaine Cha. A map can be a lot of things. On our phones, they can help us get from point A to point B and even avoid traffic in real time. At a state park, maps tucked inside a tri-fold brochure can help us navigate a trail. But maps are also a snapshot in time. And for more on that, here's producer Alex Hoyer.
A new book of rare maps, many of which have never been published, is now out from Reedy Press. The book is Mapping St. Louis, a history of the Gateway City in 40 rare maps, and its author is Andy Hahn, the longtime executive director of the historic Campbell House in downtown West St. Louis. Andy, welcome back to St. Louis on the Air.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
I've read a lot of books about St. Louis history, a lot of good ones, but I really thought that your book was a fresh take, and that is a book that charts the growth of St. Louis through maps. What was the idea for this, or when did you first get the idea for this book?
Well, I have loved maps since the time I was a little kid. I've always had maps hanging up in my house. When I was a little kid, I had a map of Europe on my wall, and ever since then I've always loved maps. And in preparing this book, I found that I'm not alone. There's a lot of map heads out there, a lot of people who love maps. So being a historian who loves maps, it's to me like the perfect combination. Two things go together.
I read that you're a seventh generation St. Louisan. Mm-hmm. So not only have you been in St. Louis for a long time, your family has too. And I'm wondering if that maybe had played a role in why you wanted to do this.
Well, it did actually, because I actually have on the wall in my hallway, and I describe this in the foreword of the book, that one of the official maps of the city of St. Louis, and in the work I've done kind of charting my family history, I've used little post-its and tabbed all the locations in the city of St. Louis where these people lived. Maps are cool tools to kind of help you understand spatially, you know, how people lived and where they went to school and shopped and how close they lived to each other and would your unconnected ancestors might have met each other in the past. To me, that's a neat thing to think about.
And so I guess seven generations, that would have been mid-1800s?
It's actually early 1800s.
Okay.
Yeah. So on my dad's side, my earliest ancestor was born here around 1800.
Oh, wow. Yeah. That's a long time ago.
It is.
So now we're going to talk about plenty of the specific maps that you include in the book. But in general, what do you think it is about telling the story of St. Louis through maps specifically that's not quite possible if you don't have maps?
Well, I'll first say that no good book of history can really, I think, tell the story properly without using some maps. And being a map lover, I think a book of all maps is the best because maps help you visualize how things grow. You can read it and you can think about it in your head, you know, that the city limits were at 4th Street or at Jefferson Avenue or Grand Avenue. But when you see that, you know, charted out or placed out on a map, I think that's really powerful. And that ultimately, I think that's what maps do. They tell stories. Sometimes they're interesting. Sometimes they're kind of maybe weird. Sometimes they can be really powerful. But that maps, I think, are the ultimate tool for telling stories about places.
Let's talk about the first map in the book. And this is from 1767. It's just 3 years after St. Louis had been founded by French fur traders. What does this first map show?
Well, it's the first map that shows the street grid of St. Louis. So that's why I call it the first map. There actually are earlier maps that show St. Louis as a dot on a map, but this shows the street grid. And it was made by the Spanish authorities. This was a new Spanish colony, even though it was founded by French fur traders as part of the settlement of the French and Indian War. France's territory in this area became Spain. And so the Spanish were coming up here to kind of take stock of what their new colony was. And that involved partially making a map. So this map, which is a manuscript, it's unique, was actually drawn and created to send back to Spain. And that's where this map still exists today. It's in the National Archives in Madrid. And it really tells the story of St. Louis as a new city or village, but it also tells the stories that there were already people in St. Louis area before St. Louis was here, specifically on the east side. The map shows St. Louis on the west side of the Mississippi, and on the east side you see the village of Cahokia, which actually is bigger than St. Louis. Cahokia is older and people had been here longer. So that's one of the stories that map tells.
Yeah, and I think that's probably, well, there were more visible signs back then of the mounds on both sides of the river. Mm-hmm. And so this map also shows those.
It does. They're very artistic. You know, they aren't accurate representations, but they are drawn on there, these kind of brown raised hills on both sides of the river. And they're all around St. Louis. So it's pretty evocative in that way.
Did you go to Spain to get a hold of this map?
I did not. The wonders of the internet and Google Translate. that map certainly came from the farthest away. Most of them came from our own area, but that one came from the farthest away and but was relatively easy to get a hold of.
So you mentioned that St. Louis was governed by Spain for most of its three or four decades of existence. Mm-hmm. But it was settled by the French. But of course, France did acquire the land, and then the United States got it in the Louisiana Purchase of 1803 that doubled the size of the country.
Right.
You have an 1804 map in the book that you call St. Louis under three flags.
Yes.
Tell us about that one.
So that is the story that's probably well known by some people, the fact that St. Louis and Upper Louisiana was part of three countries in one 24-hour period. So as part of the transfer of Louisiana from Spain to becoming part of the United States, there was this ceremony that there's multiple accounts of it occurring. The timeline of how many hours each flag was up is a little fuzzy, but that as part of the ceremony, the Spanish flag was ceremoniously lowered and the French flag put up in its place, partially as a nod to the French heritage and the French speakers in this area, but partially as part of the legal transfer and sale of Louisiana from France to America. And then after a few hours, the French flag was put down and the American flag was put up in its place. So that's the three flags in one day. And that map is kind of interesting because it actually shows exactly what St. Louis looked like on that day. The goal of the map was to not just show the blocks and the streets, but to show where every building in St. Louis was on that day.
It shows everything from the type of house.
Correct. Yeah. Wood houses, stone houses, houses that are stone and wood. It shows where they are on the blocks. Yeah. So it's a pretty cool document.
And the other thing I like about this map is that it shows the change in street names. It has what the French name was, mm-hmm. and then it has now, and then it has the English name.
Exactly. I mean, that represents the transition of that day. You know, French or Spanish, you know, these Romance languages were no longer the official languages. It was now going to be English. So you see English names on this map replacing those older names.
I learned from your book that the naming of St. Louis's streets was established in the 1820s by the then street commissioner, mm-hmm. And that the inspiration likely came from Philadelphia. What about that?
So Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, long before St. Louis in the 1820s, followed the convention that the east-west streets, and Philadelphia is built on a river just like St. Louis, so the east-west streets travel from the river. And the north-south streets travel parallel to the river. So the east-west streets are going to be named after trees, like they are in Philadelphia and in downtown St. Louis, and the north-south streets are going to be numbered. So the closer to the river you are, the lower the number. So the first, besides the levee, which is the street on the river, next block is First Street, Second Street, and so on. So in downtown St. Louis, you have Walnut and Pine and Locust and Olive and Plum and Poplar, the Poplar Street Bridge. That's where that comes from. And Elm, exactly. Myrtle was one. Vine. There's some that aren't around anymore, but those mirror just like what was in Philadelphia. So
yet there's also Market. And was that a holdover from a different map?
Market has always been Market, kind of the main thoroughfare. And maybe in some towns you might call it Main Street, but they didn't call that the kind of center access street in St. Louis was Market Street.
So up until this time, I mean, we've sped through a few decades just in this early part of our conversation. When you look at those early maps, what stands out to you about the way that they change, maybe the way that they display the growth of the city then?
Well, I think the thing that really stands out in the early maps is that St. Louis didn't grow very much at all physically in its first, you know, 5, 6, 7 decades. Between the 1760s, when the streets and blocks were first laid out, and the time of the Louisiana Purchase, there was essentially no physical growth at all in terms of spreading out geographically. Now, of course, there was growth in terms of people coming here, new settlers. The city became more dense, but there was actually not too much physical growth. And that really wouldn't happen until the 1820s and 30s when the city starts to explode. I think another thing that really maybe a lot of people don't realize when you look at those early maps, early St. Louis from the 18th century and the early 19th century is pretty much comprised today in what's entirely the Arch Grounds. That was St. Louis. It went a little north and south of what's now the Arch Grounds, but it didn't go very far west. And compared to our city today, it was extremely small.
Yeah, and I think that's some 40 city blocks. That is the Arch Grounds. And I want to get to the Arch Grounds a little bit later because, of course, to build the arch, what was there was taken down.
Yeah.
So you talked about massive growth starting in the 1820s and 30s. For people who aren't familiar with why St. Louis grew at such a rapid pace around that time, why does St. Louis grow particularly then?
Well, I think a lot of it can be attributed to the steamboat. The first steamboat arrived in St. Louis in around 1817, 1819, something like that. And that really cemented St. Louis's place as the most important spot, station, if you want to call it that, on what was quickly becoming the nation's first superhighway, the Mississippi River. The fastest and easiest way to move people, to move goods, once the steamboat was here, was the boat. And the steamboat brought thousands of people here. It brought goods. It allowed merchants to quickly take goods from St. Louis and take it other places. So the steamboat changed everything for St. Louis.
You include an 1837 map of the St. Louis Harbor in the book, and this really gets at that era of the importance of steamboats and the growth of St. Louis. And this really shares the story about Robert E. Lee, who was a young lieutenant in the Army at
exactly
the time.
Exactly right.
Tell us about how Robert E. Lee is involved with St. Louis in 1830s.
So Robert E. Lee actually drew that map. He was considered one of the country's foremost military engineers, and he was brought to St. Louis to save the St. Louis Harbor. The St. Louis Harbor was silting up. The Mississippi River was moving and changing, and it was wanting to move away from the St. Louis levee. And the river right in front of downtown St. Louis was starting to get shallow, and it became hard to pull these steamboats up to the levee. And so Robert E. Lee came to St. Louis. He surveyed the problem. He made this map. And then he came up with a plan to fix the river. And he did that by creating a series of dikes and walls that focused the flow of the river. He rightly saw that with the technology they had, that man couldn't dredge the river or control the river with machines. The river had to do it itself. And they could do that by deflecting the flow, essentially. He deflected the flow of the Mississippi right in front of the levee at St. Louis, and the power of the Mississippi River cleaned itself out. And so they were able to force the Mississippi River to stay up against the Missouri side, and that fixed the problem pretty quickly.
Was this a solution that would have been easily thought of to do? I mean, how much should we credit Robert E. Lee for coming up with this solution?
He should get a lot of credit. I mean, this was not an easy solution. It involved careful study, and you can see on the map, one of the things he had to do was take soundings or depth measurements of the entire river. And this map shows these lines that crisscross all over the river, and the lines are actually made up of series of small numbers. And so he had to first figure out how deep is the river in all these different parts. So just doing that alone was a huge undertaking. And then come up with a plan of how are we going to focus the flow of the river and do it with machines and technology that by our standard are pretty primitive. And he ended up building a dike that was over 2,000 feet long. And that was the primary tool they used to focus the flow of the river. And they just did that by dumping stones in the river, essentially. But it took years to do this. But it was very effective. So
did what he did at all affect the east side?
Yes. What was the Mississippi River in 1837 on that map, half of what was the river in 1837 is now Illinois. So he focused the flow of the river closer to Missouri. That made the river narrower, which was great for controlling the depth of the water, but it resulted in the water at St. Louis being narrower. So what is now, you know, directly across the river, East St. Louis, that was actually originally part of the river. The river was wider right at downtown. And there were islands there, and those islands have disappeared. They're now part of the land. So it's been managed pretty intensively.
Right. And is still managed pretty intensively. Very by intensively the U.S. Army today. Corps of Engineers today.
You could argue that Lee's works was the beginning of this intensive management of the river, and it's never stopped.
That's Andy Hahn, author of the new book, Mapping St. Louis, A History of the Gateway City in 40 Rare Maps. He's talking with producer Alex Hoyer, and we'll get back to their conversation in just a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio.
If you have a smart speaker, you have access to the entire world of NPR and St. Louis Public Radio. All the latest news and all the captivating stories. Activate our voices with yours by telling your smart speaker to play St. Louis Public Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Eileen Cha. Let's return to our conversation between producer Alex Hoyer and Andy Hahn. Andy is the executive director of the historic Campbell House Museum in St. Louis and the author of the new book, Mapping St. Louis, A History of the Gateway City in 40 Rare Maps.
There are two maps in the book that show disasters specifically. One is the 1849, what was called the Great Fire of St. Louis, and the other one is an 1896 map that is a great cyclone map, which was just a horrible tornado that killed 305 people. Why did you want to include these disaster maps in the book?
Well, I wanted to include them because I think probably most St. Louisans, especially any St. Louisan with a knowledge of local history, has probably heard of these events. And I think it makes the disaster seem more real and maybe more powerful. If you can see it charted on a map, you can see where the destruction was. And it's an important part of our history, especially the fire. It really kind of changed the direction of what's now downtown St. Louis and how it was growing and how it built. It presented an opportunity to kind of start over when a fire, you know, demolishes a lot of blocks. It really allows you to rethink how you're going to build and grow.
Can you talk about where that Great Fire of St. Louis was and just the story of it, how it started?
Sure. So it was in May of 1849. And it's interesting. I never made the connection until you just put those two maps together. But both these disasters happened in May. So May 1849, a fire started on a steamboat. It was called the White Cloud. The fire got out of control to the point where the people in charge of the steamboat said, we're not going to be able to put this out. So in an effort to stop the fire from spreading, they cut the boat free with the hope that, you know, the water would push it away from the levee and it would go downriver and save the city and other boats from any danger. The problem was the current and the wind was as such that the boat did pull free. But as soon as it started to float down the river, it got pushed back into other boats. And very quickly, a whole row of steamboats was on fire. Because these boats, when they would pull up on the levee, they were packed very tightly together. Not touching, but sometimes pretty close. And within a short time, over 20 of these boats were on fire. You know, they were wood, paint. They had flammable materials on them. The fire jumps the levee and starts to burn buildings. And very quickly, the fire is out of control. So if you go down to the arch and just stand at the stairs on the top of the arch and look down between the arch and the Eads Bridge, that's approximately where this fire started. And most of the fire damage was an area of St. Louis that's now the arch grounds. But it was a pretty serious fire to the point where, with their primitive firefighting technology, they knew they couldn't control it. They couldn't stop it. And so they resorted to dynamite. And to create a fire break, they began to blow buildings up preemptively to stop the fire from spreading.
And it worked.
And it did work, yeah. It did work. People died in the process. Famously, one of the men setting this dynamite, because gunpowder and dynamite was blown up in the process in an accident. But it did work and saved more of the city from being destroyed. And the cool thing about that map is it shows exactly which blocks were affected. And then at the top of the map is this very dramatic view from where the Illinois side of the city in flames.
Mm, yeah. The map of the tornado.
Mm-hmm.
This map features the map of St. Louis, but the area in which the tornado was is highlighted in red.
Yeah.
Why was this even a map that was created?
Well, just like today, people love disasters. And you want to hear all about it. And just like when a disaster happens now, you know, the news is there, the media is there, people read about it, they want information about it. And that's what this map did. The map itself predates the tornado. It was an existing map. But an enterprising gentleman got the idea that if we take this red ink and print it on this existing map, with the path of tornado, that's going to be something that people were interested in. And that's what he did. He took an existing map. He charted out the blocks and the path of the tornado. And then this, it looks like a big red kind of splotch, goes right over the city from Tower Grove Park. And it kind of goes towards the east. And then it curves up towards downtown and crosses the river. And it's very dramatic seeing this huge red splotch. And it was a huge disaster. Adjusted for inflation, my research told me that it is still the costliest tornado in American history, given the amount of destruction that happened. You know, imagine a tornado going directly through a very dense populated area with lots of buildings. So,
and this at the time was one of the most populated places in the entire country.
Yeah, I mean, there could be, you know, in one little area, there could be hundreds or even maybe 1,000 people living on one block. I mean, that's dense.
Yeah.
And to have a tornado come through and demolish buildings and just rip things apart. You know, there's famous photos of Lafayette Park where there are no trees left.
Mm.
All the trees are kind of broken off at about 6 or 8 feet. Mm. That'll give you a sense of the power of this.
One of my favorite maps in the book is one that I suspect some of our listeners will know, and that's Pictorial St. Louis, mm-hmm. and it's from 1875, and it's sometimes just called the Compton and Dry Map. The Missouri History Museum had an exhibit,
2015,
I thank
believe.
You.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. It was a great exhibit. But what's stunning about this map is that it is in such intricate detail. For people who don't know about this Pictorial St. Louis, this Compton and Dry Map, describe it.
Well, like you said, it is unbelievably detailed, and it is still considered by historians and map makers and view makers today to be the most detailed representation of a 19th century city ever made. First of all, it's massive. It's so massive that this map had to be broken up into 110 different pieces. Each piece is about 20 inches wide. When you take all 110 pieces and fit them together, the map is something like 14 feet wide. It is huge. And it is so detailed that it's not a map in the truest sense in the world because it's not flat. It's got a dimension to it. But it is so detailed that every building that appears on this, you could see every window.
Mm-hmm.
You could see every door. And that's not, you know, an artist kind of fudging that. It's thought that surveyors and artists fanned out across the whole city and, you know, recorded the details of every single building. Buildings that stand today that are on this map bear that out. They match these views perfectly. And it is an unbelievable tool for the history of our city, for historians, for genealogists, to see exactly what St. Louis looked like at this time, at the height of the Gilded Age in the 1870s.
It's even the cover of the book. So
it is the cover of the book.
I assume it's one that you really like as well.
Well, it's, you know, it's certainly one of the most important, some people might argue the most important map of St. Louis ever made. So it's well known, but in some ways it's not well known. You know, historians know it, but probably most St. Louisans don't. And it's the type of thing, it's easily available. The whole thing's easily available online, and it's the type of thing you can really, you know, lose yourself in real quick.
So we've been in the 1800s for a long time, mm-hmm. and I'm going to stay there because there's the Great Divorce of 1876, mm-hmm. which we know as locking in the geographic borders of St. Louis. Mm-hmm. At the time, people in the city of St. Louis didn't want to be responsible for people in the county and the infrastructure development in the county, but it mm-hmm. really and has permanently constrained the city, unlike other cities in this country. How is that reflected in the book?
So there's kind of two maps that tell that story in the book. One is from shortly after the Great Divorce, and it's from 1878. And it was a map done by a well-known and important surveyor in St. Louis, a guy named Julius Pitzman. And the map's actually from something called Pitzman's Atlas of St. Louis. And it really shows that fixed border of the city for the first time. And that's the border that we still have today. You know, just beyond Skinker Boulevard on the west, that was the border set in 1876 and is still the border today. If you fast forward all the way to 1962, there's a great map in the book talking about something called the Borough Plan. And this was an effort to put Humpty Dumpty back together again, essentially, to kind of recreate St. Louis, to do away with that border, that line, and create a kind of a mega city that would encompass all of what is today St. Louis City and St. Louis County, and then divide that mega city up into a series of boroughs like New York City. And that's something that actually went to a vote in 1962.
I've been here a while, and I think that it is one of the things that holds this area back, and I don't think it'll be considered in any meaningful way anytime soon, but decades from now, it comes up again. And there are certainly examples of cooperation between the city and the county with the Metropolitan Sewer District, Metro Transit.
And that was actually interesting that you mentioned those things, because that's in 1962 why the Borough Plan was seen as the perfect solution at that time. Because in the previous decade, in the 1950s, they did develop Metro. They did develop the Metropolitan Sewer District. They did develop the Community College District, all these very successful cooperations between city and county. So it was seen as the next step in 1962. Yeah, this is the next step. Here we can cooperate and work more efficiently together.
You include some maps in the book of Forest Park and of mm-hmm. the 1904 World's Fair that took place, of course, in Forest Park.
Right.
And I bring this up because the Missouri History Museum opened this past April a new 1904 World's Fair exhibit, and it includes a large 3D model of the fair. And while not technically a map, I think it kind of does what a map does. Mm-hmm. And I'm curious how you view that model of the fair in the present day in that exhibit compared to some of the maps that you've come across in your research.
So they used a flat traditional map to make that model, because the map was the best tool to visualize where were the streets, where were the buildings, the relationships of the buildings between each other. You know, I think creating the model, you know, essentially as a 3D map was a brilliant idea, and the fact that they project on top of that model, and so the model can kind of change slightly. And if you're there at the right moment, you know, you can actually see them project down on the model the Google Earth view of St. Louis today. That's really powerful. You know, you see a whole section of the fair that is now a neighborhood, and you can see the buildings that stood there in 1904. But, you know, we had to talk about Forest Park and you got to talk about the fair. So I had to include one of those. But I wanted to do it in an interesting way. And that 1904 map is actually told through three maps made in 1904, all of Forest Park. It's a map of the park before the fair, a map of the park during the fair, and then a map of the park for the plan to restore the park after the fair. So to me, that was a really interesting before, during, after, kind of, you could compare those.
There are other maps in the book. I'm curious if there's any map that that you want to point out that we haven't talked about so far.
Well, one of my favorite maps in the book is it's from 2017, and that spring, St. Louis hosted the annual meeting and expo for the American Alliance of Museums. And as part of that, the group commissioned a local artist named Dan Zetwak to create a pictorial map of museums of St. Louis. And it's a map that, illustrates and points out, on a map, the huge wealth of museums that St. Louis offers. Not just the big museums like the History Museum or the Art Museum, but, little museums and house museums and libraries. And it just really illustrates how lucky we are. And I could tell you, I was at that convention and people came from New Zealand and Germany and everywhere, all 50 states, and everyone was super impressed with St. Louis and what they had to offer in terms of museums. And so that I love that map because it really tells that story, and it tells it in a fun visual way. Dan's this great artist, and it's colorful, and it's almost cartoony, and he is really good at drawing buildings and objects. It's just a really fun map.
Dan Zetwak also did some work for St. Louis Public Radio's STL Welcome Kit that is very much what you describe. He's a tremendous artist.
Yeah.
You've gone through a lot of maps.
Mm-hmm.
What are some of the keys to making a good one?
Well, I think it has to be easy to read. And that was a challenge with the book because with maybe two exceptions, all the maps in the book are printed smaller than they actually are in real life. Mm. So that was difficult, but I worked really hard to choose maps that would reproduce well. And you may need a magnifying glass for some of them, but try to get them in a quality enough that even with the naked eye, you could really read them and understand them. So that's the most important. You have to be able to read it and use it and understand it. For purposes of this book, and I think the best maps are also actually visually beautiful and interesting. And that doesn't mean they have to be color, but they have to be designed well, because that's ultimately what a map is. It's a piece of design. So those two components, I think, are the most important: readability and, visual kind of appeal.
I'm sure you came across a lot of poorly drawn maps.
I did. And actually, I've been choosing...
Are any of those in the book?
Well, I don't think so, because in choosing them, I kind of had a rating system, because at one point I had hundreds of maps, mm-hmm. a list, and, I gave kind of a 1 through 5 number, 5 being visually the most beautiful and interesting. And so that helped me winnow down my list. I kind of threw the 1s and 2s off right away because they wouldn't reproduce well. They'd be really boring. It would have been really easy to create a book of black and white maps. but that wouldn't be, very interesting for the eye. So
I think a lot of times people don't really get physical maps anymore. I mean, mm-hmm. we get so used to maps, pulling up Google Maps or Waze on our phones to get from place to place.
Yeah.
And they're great. They can update in real time, help us avoid traffic. As a kid, I remember having those big atlases books.
Mm-hmm.
and
for road trips.
Yeah. And or you'd go to AAA and get the
triptych.
The triptych.
Someone told me I did a presentation about the book that they still make those.
Yeah.
If you can believe it.
Well, and if you're a AAA member, you can go into a AAA office. Well, at least this was true 6 or 7 years ago, and you can get maps, mm-hmm. State maps.
And most states still print
map.
Them.
Yeah. But I feel like a lot of people don't really use physical maps anymore. I think the last time that I used one is I picked one up at Castlewood State Park.
Mm-hmm.
It's in that nice brochure. It shows all the different trails, and I used it. Of course, you can also have a Map My Trails or All Trails and
sure.
pull it up on your phone. But there's something about
holding
a physical map, and I don't quite know what it is. But do you have any idea?
Well, I think you're right. There's something about holding it, about the tangible act of being able to handle it, and I think part of that is the discovery. When you hold it and you can, if it's multiple pages, you can flip the pages or you can fold it over and get that closer view. My wife can't go on a road trip without the Atlas in her lap, even though you have the phone. And to me, the irony of it is, of course, maps are more used and accessible than they ever have been in the history of the world because of mobile devices. But I think map skills and map reading are probably, you know, on their way down, so to speak, because the phone does it for you. You know, the phone will automatically orientate you on the map. It will automatically point north. It will tell you which way to turn. And in prepping the book, I read an article by a neurologist who really lamented the fact that people were losing their mental map-making skills. Mm-hmm. And as a scientist, he had studied that that was one of the most important things for the neurons in your brain was to create these mental maps. And it's as simple as, you know, when you learn to drive, you make a map in your head and you know from your home how you get to your school or your church. You go out the drive and you take a left and a right and you turn at the park and all those sorts of things. And I don't think people are doing that in quite the same way that we did before we had a mobile device, you know, because now it doesn't matter. You just put it in the phone and it tells you turn left, turn right. And then maybe you're focusing more on the phone than you are on what's out the windows.
Andy Hahn is the author of the new book, Mapping St. Louis, A History of the Gateway City in 40 Rare Maps. Thanks so much for being here.
My pleasure.
Today's episode was produced by our executive producer, Alex Hoyer.
Audio engineering and podcast design by Aaron Dorr.
St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio. Understanding starts here.
Do you find yourself regularly listening to episodes of St. Louis on the Air? Suggest us to a friend you think might enjoy our conversations. And leave us a review and rating on Apple Podcasts on the App Store. It's the simplest way to help people discover our show. Thanks.
St. Louis Public Radio is a member-supported service of the University of Missouri St. Louis.
The Gateway brings you the day's news each weekday from around the St. Louis region and the state capitals in Jefferson City.
Our schools are accredited. We don't need this bill.
And Springfield.
How many more years must pass before lawmakers see time is of the essence?
I'm Abby Larico. Join me each weekday for The Gateway on the STLPR app or wherever you get podcasts.